All right, we are going to get going. A few more people might wander in, but we always run out of time, so I'm going to start right at 11:15. Let's pray together. Lord, we are so privileged to be here at Mount Hermon. There are many families who would love to do something like this and simply can't, and so we don't take for granted the fact that we are just blessed and can come here with our families, enjoy this beautiful place, enjoy each other, enjoy hearing the Word of God preached powerfully, music and worship, and now the seminar. And I pray that this would be a time when we can reflect on things going on in our culture and about our kids, and that you would just guide us into wisdom regarding this issue. In Jesus' name we pray, amen. Amen. You guys having a good week? You sure got a beautiful one, man. It's just really, really nice. Well, we are going to be talking about parenting your kids through tough questions about faith. And what I want to start with is just start giving you some of the research that's out there, the bad news, so to speak, that our kids, your kids, my kids, the especially they're looking at the millennials right now, are leaving the faith. So we want to look at why is that going on. But let me just go through some of this research first. This is a great URL that I gave you in your notes. By the way, there's notes when you come in the door. Make sure you got those. This URL, you can go and what I love about this is he's kind of summarized all these research projects that are out there, and he kind of gives you the synopsis of the bottom line of what they're saying. So it's a great resource for understanding what's going on. But let me just give you some of the things that are in here. For instance, Pew Research is the top research institute for studying religion in America and around the world. And they do these massive religion surveys. The most recent one was in 2015. They're probably working on one even as we speak. And what's interesting, between 2007, which was the last really big one, and 2015, they are showing that people who, when they're surveyed, check the box that says Christian, going down the list of options of who you are affiliated with, what group, 78% in 2007 said Christian, and that would be any variety of Christian. And in 2015, that number is down to 70.6%. Again, these are just self-identified. These aren't necessarily people who are devout or go to church or anything, but they just sort of check that box. Adults who describe themselves as none, researchers call these people the nuns, not N-U-N-S, but N-O-N-E-S. So when you go down the list and it's Christian, Muslim, whatever, there's lists, and then it's none, this is the box that's being checked. Look at the increase, 16.1% in 07, up to 22.8% in 2015. And some of the more recent, smaller surveys that have been done have brought that number up to about a quarter, almost 25% now of people ages 18 and up in America will check a box saying they're not affiliated with any particular religion. Now, this doesn't mean that all 25% are atheists. They might be agnostic, they might be atheists, or they might just say, I have my own spirituality, I don't affiliate with any particular religion. But that's a growing number, and all the researchers think that this number is just going to keep going up and up. Another survey that was done recently in a book called Exodus, Why Americans Are Leaving Religions, and this is about religion more broadly, not just Christianity or evangelicalism. This was done in 2016. This showed that 39% of young adults, so almost 40% that are ages 18 to 29, that's the millennials, are religiously unaffiliated. So this number of 22 or even 25% is very skewed when you zero in on the younger people. It's much higher percentage of those. So because only 13% of seniors consider themselves unaffiliated. So this is a huge cultural shift going on in our culture. The other thing that's very interesting in all of these studies is showing that Americans who do leave their childhood religion are doing so before reaching adulthood, before they go off to college, before they become an adult. 79% of young adults 18 to 29 who become unaffiliated report making this decision during their adolescent and teen years. So that means that our high schoolers, maybe some of your high schoolers, have already decided when they get out and up on their own, religion's not going to be a part of their life. Or your junior hires. We have a junior high up through eighth grade at our church, a Christian school, and the pastor who teaches Bible says it's amazing that some of these eighth graders have already decided they don't believe in God. And they've been coming up through the Christian school. You know, so even at that younger age, and we're going to talk about why kids at that age might be making these kind of decisions. Souls in Transition, another study that was done in 2009. Again, that's getting to be a little old. That's 9 years old. So, but it's interesting when they talk to what they call emerging adults. So, these are students who are kind of finishing up college and moving out into the workplace and their lives. Only 15% embrace what they would call a strong faith, a faith that affects how they live their life that they would consider very, very important. 30% tend to customize their faith. So we like to do that. We're a salad bar buffet culture. Right? We like to go down the line and go, I like this, I'll have some of that, not very much of this, a lot of that, and absolutely none of this. And that's what we do with our religion as well. We don't like packaged religion. We like to customize our religion and make it suit ourselves. So a lot of customization going on out there, even if they still say that they're a Christian or some other religion. 15% believe very vaguely in a higher power. They're moving away from any concept of God. One of the things I hear a lot in Santa Cruz, where I live, is I hear this all the time. The other day at Trader Joe's, a woman was out in the parking lot saying to somebody, I just thank the universe that I, whatever, it was something she was happy about. I'm like, thanking the universe. And I also called somebody. We had accidentally forgot through a series of events to leave a tip for a waitress. And I was calling the restaurant to say, I'm mailing the tip in. And the woman who took my call said, that is just so nice. That's just great karma for you to do that. Just, you know, so this is, you know, kind of the higher power. All of that is out there. 5%. Of these emerging adults have no exposure whatsoever, they say, to religious people or ideas or organizations. Now, you might go, well, how can that possibly be? But I tell you, we meet people in Santa Cruz when Renee gets out into the community who say they've never, ever been to church except for maybe a funeral. And most weddings aren't in churches anymore, right? So they're not even there for weddings. And a lot of funerals are at out by the beach. So 5% say they don't even know a religious person. Are there still religious people? You know, I actually teach a course up at UCSC, a staff training course called Understanding Religious Belief and Believers, because they're such a rare thing at UCSC. They're like, I don't know what to do. There's somebody on staff here who's religious. I don't know what to do about that. So I teach a training course in their diversity program. Isn't that interesting? So, and 10% fully skeptical of religious faith. Now, these are the militant people that say religion's a bunch of hooey. We'd all be better off without it. They try to talk you out of faith. So 10%. So that's a very interesting study. Lifeway Research in 2007, again, this is getting a little old. 70% of young people will leave the faith in college and only 35% eventually return. But a 2007 study is really kind of looking at more that previous generation. And we don't know what's going to happen with millennials who are leaving the faith at a much faster pace. The Fuller Youth Institute, 2010, 40 to 50% of students in youth groups, they call these youth group graduates, meaning they stayed involved in youth group all the way through high school. 40 to 50% of them still struggle with their faith after graduation. So we cannot bury our heads in the sand and go, well, I'm raising my kid in a Christian family and he goes to Sunday school, everything's going to be fine. The research is saying that's just not the case. So what are the reasons? Why are our kids leaving? Well, first and foremost is just the influence of our secular culture. Secular basically means that all the emphasis is on the here and now without any concept of transcendence or eternity or anything like that. It's all about the here and now. And all of the human needs that we have. We need meaning in life and purpose. We need satisfaction. We want to have freedom. We want to have an identity. We want to have some hope. We want to see justice done. Most people, as human beings, we have this. And what has happened is that secularism is providing ways for people to have meaning and identity. It's telling a story about how you can have all of that without God. In fact, the story it's telling is that you will find these things better without God. That God and religion is a hindrance, for instance, to finding your true identity. And the irony is just how wrong that is. But that's what our secular culture is constantly saying. Now, where are our kids picking up this secular message? Well, it's around us all the time. It's like we're like fish in water that don't realize what water is. The secular culture and way of thinking influences us, even as Christians, in ways we don't even realize it's doing. For instance, in ads, in movies, in songs, pop culture, social media, in sports, in the news, just different cultural trends. The internet is a huge source for this. And we're just getting this just in the air we breathe, and your kids are exposed to more of this than I was as a kid, and that probably you were as a kid. So we have to realize the messages that our kids are getting all the time. For example, our culture tells us that individual freedom, complete autonomous freedom, is the highest value. It's like number one priority, that you can choose whatever you want about what you do and so forth. To choose your own moral values. No one can tell you what's moral and what's not, you know, as long as you don't harm anyone. But of course, what does that mean? You can even choose your own gender. No one, not even your body, can tell you what your gender is, right? And no one can tell you what your gender is. You can choose. You have freedom. And really, in our society, the only sin that is not tolerated is intolerance for someone else's choices, right? And our kids pick this up, that this is a high value. Look at this ad. This was playing a lot during the Warriors, if you watch the playoffs. And I realized, as I saw this so many times, what this song, Subway just picked this song to advertise their sandwiches. But listen to the lyrics of this song and what it's saying. All right, so that's fine for Subway sandwiches, right? Make it what you want. But really, this song is about life. Let me just show you the lyrics again of that. It says, you can do and you can say anything you want and live your life, and I'll live mine any way I want. Any way I want. So these commercials are on and you think it's not having an influence, but over time and over life, these messages get through. And if we don't have a counter message where Jesus says, actually, if you try to find your life just on your own, you're going to lose it. If you live your life any way you want, you're going to lose your life. But if you actually give your life to me and sacrifice it to me, you're gonna find your life. That's so paradoxical, but that is the gospel. And so we have to constantly you know, be aware of the messages that our kids are getting. So this is just the influence of our secular culture in so many different ways. I could show you many, many, many other illustrations, even in Disney songs. Like Elsa in Frozen says, no rules for me, you know, I'm going to find me and no one's going to tell me who I am. So those kind of messages are everywhere. Intellectual doubt is another reason. This is a very big reason. These are anything from philosophical questions, such as the problem of evil in the world. And these questions have been around for a very long time. I was just talking to a Jewish woman a few weeks ago who's an atheist. She's in her 90s, and her family actually fled the Holocaust. And she said, I can't believe in God because I can't believe there could be a good God who could allow the Holocaust to happen. So I don't believe there is one. And there's the irony of that is that ultimately then you can't say that the Holocaust is wrong. But, you know, people don't usually quite go there all the way. They don't follow that train of reasoning. But so this is a really big question that's been around for ages, I think, since Old Testament times. You know, why do the heathens rage? Why does it seem like the bad win? You know, these are questions we have. The very existence of God, sometimes kids are like, I just don't even know if God exists. How do we even know that? What are some reasons you believe in God? Hell is a very big issue right now, especially as kids are very aware. If you live in California, your kids are probably going to school with Muslims and Buddhists and Hindus and kids of no religion. They're like, really, God would send those kids to hell just because they don't come to church? You know, that's kind of their idea. So, you know, what are we communicating about that? The Bible, can we trust it? Because there's a lot on the internet, a lot of false stuff on the internet, but just a lot of stuff that says that the Bible's full of errors, it's just man-made hooey. How can Christianity be the only true religion? Isn't it possible that all religions somehow lead to God? And then the big question of science. It's really unfortunate that our many evangelical churches, I don't know about yours, but can be very anti-science. Like, science is bad, and you need to stay away from it. And the problem is when kids get into college and they take science courses, and it's amazing, and they're like, science isn't bad, it's awesome, so I guess I can't be a Christian because I love science. What a terrible message. All of the first scientists in the classic sense that we know science were all believers. They were all Christians who thought that the world could be discovered because God created it and that it was ours to discover. So science is really a Christian endeavor. And I know there are scientists who say you can't be a scientist and be a Christian, but that's just wrong. And if there are scientists in your churches, we need to be introducing them to our kids. And having them come to youth group, having them talk about how they see their faith and their science is compatible. I just picked up a new book. I haven't finished reading it, so I can't just unabashedly recommend it. And it's not on your list because I just found it. It's called Mere Science and Christian Faith, Bridging the Divide with Emerging Adults. It's by Greg Koutsona. Koutsona. You can come and look at it if you want to get that title. But what's interesting is he did not become a Christian until he was in college. He grew up totally, he said, I was a cross between an atheist and agnostic. I just didn't think God was relevant to anything in my life. The whole question was irrelevant. And guess where he went to school? UC Berkeley. And he became a Christian. I love that. And he's a scientist, and he became a Christian. So already he has some creds, right? He's going the opposite way that some of our kids are going. So again, I don't know what all he says in here, but clearly he is a scientist who is a person of faith and does not see that as incompatible. So we need to not be anti-science. Now, these intellectual doubts can really derail our kids if we don't take the time. Really, we have to start answering these questions before they even know they have the question. They need to be things we talk about in our families and in our youth groups and in small groups before they even think of that objection to Christian faith, because they will get it when they get out. So my youngest son, my kids, by the way, are 20, 26, and 28. So right in that millennial range. My youngest son, one of his very good friends, last year announced that he no longer, and he was raised in a very conservative Christian family, homeschool family, very, very devout, and he announced that he no longer believed in any of it. And he started a blog this March 19th of last year, Questions to Challenge the Christian Worldview. And this was his first post, and these are all his objections to the Christian worldview. There's like 8 pages. Now, a lot, I read through all of this, and a lot of this stuff I recognized from the internet and from various atheist authors that I've also read. Like, I know where he got that. And I did respond to him and said, some of these are great questions that have been around for a very long time that even ancient Christian thinkers were dealing with hundreds of years ago, and modern Christian thinkers. Have you looked at what any of the modern Christian thinkers or ancient Christian thinkers have said about any of these things? Because there was no indication that he had. And he said, well, I feel like I've already heard all the other, that side. And now I'm now hearing this side, and I think this side is more compelling. And he did say, you could send me a few book suggestions and I'll see what I can do. But I have seen him a few times and there's no indication that he has read any of them. So it's very sad, because once they kind of take that leap into I don't believe now and have announced it to everyone, everything he posts now is not only just reinforcing that, it's challenging people who are of faith. He kind of feels like he's been enlightened and needs to enlighten everyone else. And so intellectual questions, I don't know how they were dealt with in his family, I just don't know, but they need to be dealt with. None of these things are gonna keep your kids from leaving the faith, but there's just some cumulative things that maybe we can do. Negative experience or observation is another reason kids leave. Maybe they think the church is full of hypocrites. Maybe they screwed up and they weren't shown grace. And they say, Christians talk grace, but all they do is judge. Maybe they get a message that our Christianity is really about politics and they don't agree with, you know, what the politics are of your church or whatever. Maybe they don't like the story being told that Christians are anti-gay, we're anti-immigrants, we're anti-everything, you know, we hate. And so they get this negative impression, or they have these negative experiences, and they want to leave it. Lack of an articulate faith is also really big. Christian Smith and Melinda Denton wrote a book called Soul Searching: The Religious and Spiritual Lives of American Teenagers. And their research showed that the majority of teenagers are incredibly inarticulate about their faith, about religious beliefs and practices, and about its place in their lives. These were kids in churches, many, many kids that they interviewed about their faith. And what they said is the de facto dominant religion among contemporary U.S. teenagers who are in church is what they called moralistic therapeutic deism. Now, it's not that they didn't find any kids who were articulate, obviously they did, but they said this actually was the dominant religion that we found. What is this? Well, it believes that a God exists who created and orders the world and watches over human life on earth, so kind of the big blur in the sky. God wants people to be good and nice and fair to each other. That's taught in the Bible, and it's taught in all the world religions as well. And central goal of life is to be happy and to feel good about oneself. That's the goal of life. And God does not need to be particularly involved in one's life except when God is needed to resolve a problem. So you pray when there's a crisis, otherwise God just sort of lets you, you know, do your thing as long as you're being good and nice and fair. And good people go to heaven when they die. Now this faith is not going to survive college. and adulthood in the secular world that's out there. It's not robust enough. So this inarticulate faith is one of the reasons that kids are leaving. They just don't really even know their faith. And then also this faith can just become irrelevant. And this is just one of those facts that when, and think back on your own young adulthood when you became 18 and maybe went away to college and you're like, wow, I can get up when I want. I can do what I can wear what I want. No, no one's telling me what to do. You kind of find this new freedom. It's exciting. You have all these new adventures. It's college. It's friends. It's romance. And sometimes kids just like, I don't really know what God has to do with any of that. So I'm just going to enjoy all of this. It's just irrelevant for me right now. So they sort of shelve their faith. And maybe they take it off the shelf later, and maybe they don't. Sometimes they'll say, I tried Christianity, it just didn't work for me. You've heard that. Or maybe they're just rebelling against their upbringing. There's all kinds of reasons. Sometimes there's cognitive dissonance, and that's where they know that, for instance, sleeping around is not right. It's immoral. But they really want to do that. They want to sleep with their boyfriend, girlfriend. They want to enjoy the party scene. Everybody's fun. That's where all the fun is taking place. And you can't really hold both of those things as high values for very long. It's psychologically, you have this cognitive, you have to let go of one or the other. And so they'll just go, well, the Bible, what does it really say? Where exactly would it say that? No, I think it's okay. What did it know about sexuality? We're in a new era, all of these things. And so they let it go. So these are all various reasons. There's probably many more that maybe you can even tell me about. But I don't mean to just for this be a depressing seminar for you to go trudging up to lunch going, it's terrible, I can't, what's the point? Well, yes, that's the truth. Okay, now the good news is there are things we can do. There's nothing surefire, but there are things that we can do. And first and foremost, you have to recognize that parents do matter. Parents do matter. Several key findings were discovered in a 35-year study of families, focusing on this question of how religious faith is passed from generation to generation. And the bottom line is that parents continue to be the single greatest influence on their children's faith, probably for good or for bad, frankly. Now, a good resource for you, oh, and by the way, I just read this morning on that according to a recent Barna report, I'm going to save that for my next point. Let me recommend a book. This is in the bookstore, hopefully. I asked her to stock quite a few of these. Sticky Faith, Everyday Ideas to Build Lasting Faith into Your Kids. Especially if you have kids at home, even if they're just toddlers now, pick up this book. What I love about Kara Palin, she's down at the Fuller Youth Institute, is how practical this book is. It's not just, it is based on research, but they kind of take that research and they go, what are practical things that you can do as a parent? Where it's not beating your kids over the head with the Bible every day, but building real, genuine faith into their lives. As a family, I think it's an excellent book. I thought it was very well written. So parents do matter. And some of the things that she brings out and that I have just found in our own family are very important is, let me just give you a few of these, creating a home environment of warmth and grace and unconditional love. These are God qualities that we want to be modeling to our children. As people of faith, we want to model these characteristics of God. Now, what do I mean by warmth? Family warmth. In that 35-year study, they found that family warmth was more correlated with faith transmission than any other relational factor. What is family warmth? That's the sense of closeness where kids say, yeah, I'm close to my mom, I'm close to my dad. That sense of warmth where you actually enjoy being together, you laugh together, you feel close. Now, that can be difficult to achieve sometimes in families for a variety of reasons. Technology can be a huge thief of warmth because we're all on our own devices. We might be sitting in the same room, but we're not actually together because we're all on our own pad or phone or laptop or whatever. And so we have to be really careful with technology. That's a whole other seminar for somebody else to do, but that can steal warmth. One thing with family warmth, our family's a very huggy family. We hug each other a lot daily. At Christmas, every single gift gets a hug from whoever gave it, you know. I was not raised that way, but Renee was raised that way, and so we really just adopted that, and it's wonderful. When my oldest son, I always tell my oldest son, Jonathan, honey, I made all my worst mistakes on you because you were my oldest and I had never been there before. Whatever age you turned, I had never had a kid that age before, so I apologize. But when he turned about 13, 14 years old, and one day he was like, good night, Mom, and the next morning was like, good morning, Mom, and I was like, what happened? It seems like it happens that fast, right? Your little boy becomes a young man, and it was not anything I actually thought to myself, but for some reason, I just responded this way, where I'm like, well, he's a young man now, and I don't hug men other than my husband, you know, so I kind of quit hugging him. I kind of felt like he wouldn't want me to. He's a young man now, and they don't want hugs from their mother. You know what? They want hugs from their mother. That was a mistake. And slowly, I was able to build that back in. And the reason that's so important is because in those teenage years is when you have the greatest potential for conflict with your kids, right? It's when they want to wear this or do this or they don't want it, and you need them to do it. And so there's that. And they're becoming adults, so it's that rocky transition of adolescence that you're going to go through. Even with a great kid, you're going to have those times. So keeping the warmth is so crucial. Keeping the, yeah, I'm mad at you, but oh, I love you, good night. You know, that hug, that warmth is really important. So keep the warmth in your family. Also, bring your children into your faith life. In other words, if you're struggling even with a doubt, to bring your children into that and talk about how you're working through that, that's good. Because it teaches them that having doubts is not the end of faith. It's part of faith. We all go through doubts in various areas. Or if you're really struggling to trust God about something, you know, bring your kids into that. Say, you know, we're just not having enough income for all of the things we need to buy in our family. And I'm really trusting God. Really, that's what I want to do. I really want to trust God that he's going to provide for us. And bring them into that, because that shows your kids how faith matters, what difference it makes in your life. So bring kids into your faith life. This article, let me go back to it. Is in I think it's the current CT or it's on CT online, but it's the Great Commission Starts in Your Backyard. And she talks about the importance of basically seeing, for mothers to see, and fathers really, that the first part of the Great Commission of bringing people to know the Lord, your first responsibility is to your own kids. And she talks about trying to have faith conversations, because according to a recent Barna report, on spiritual conversations in a digital age, children who grow up regularly talking about faith and seeing their parents integrate faith into everyday life are much more likely to continue being actively engaged in their faith as they grow older. In other words, parents who are eager to talk with their children about spiritual matters raise kids who are likewise eager. And this is absolutely true in our family. You have to make that regular space for conversation to take place. Because if your life is all about, quick, get your clothes on, we're going to be late, hey, now you're at school, now you're going to this club, now you're at this sport, now quick, we're going through the drive-thru, here's some dinner, now go to bed, you know. I know, that sounds familiar. Where's the space where a question could pop up? And you can't force those things. There has to be space for it. So in our family, the family dinner was sacred. Renee had to be home from work for dinner. And the kids, and I mean, even through high school, we eat together for dinner, unless you have a really good reason why you're not going to be there. We eat together. And I love that. And my kids loved it as well. In fact, my kids, when they were in high school, they went to a public high school. They said, you know, Mom, when we mentioned that we have family dinner every night, none of our friends in high school have family dinner. They don't eat together. They drive through. Mom says, there's a pizza in the oven. I'm going to my workout, you know, whatever. And that they don't have that space. You have to be intentional about creating space, because questions can come up in that environment, or you can talk about faith and have spiritual conversations that aren't heavy. Dinners are what, a half an hour long, so these don't have to be long drawn out. And what I love about those family dinners is either milk was coming out of somebody's nose because we were all laughing so hard, and that creates warmth, or out of the blue, somebody was saying, like Jonathan one night said, so how do we know that Jesus really rose from the dead? And I'm like, that's a great question. Of course you should ask that question, because you know what? Most people don't rise from the dead. In fact, 99.9999999% of people do not come back from death. So why do we think this guy did? That I told him, that is a brilliant question. You're so smart to have asked that question. Now, if one of your kids asked you that question, would you say, well, we just take it on faith? That's not a good answer. You need to have something in your arsenal. And I'm not saying you, in that moment, you download N.T. Wright's Resurrection of the Son of God that you can use as a book, you know, a book doorstop. It's so huge. You can't do that to a kid, but you could have one thing. You know what really made me think that this story is true is this. Boom. And so I did that with Jonathan. He was, you know, young teenager. I can't remember exactly how age. And he was, and after just one or two things, he's like, oh, cool. So more spaghetti, you know, and that's it. But that's how it happens if you have space. The other thing is in the car. My youngest son decided not to get his driver's license when he was 16. He said, I don't really want to drive. And I'll get it when I'm 18. And I thought, drat, I have to keep driving him to high school for two more years. But then I realized, oh, those precious moments in the car, because it's 20 minutes there and 20 minutes home. Sometimes we sat in companionable silence. Sometimes we had amazing conversations that reflected on faith and things he was hearing at school. So you've got to create space. And then also make it clear that these questions and doubts are okay. Make it clear. You never want to indicate that somehow they're sinning by having a doubt, even if their doubts are serious. Make clear that not only can you handle the doubts, but God can handle your doubts as well. Take them to the Psalms and go, look at David. Look how he was expressing his doubts. This is okay. This is part of faith, and it's how you grow deeper in your faith. So make it clear that doubts are okay. And then also, obviously, just pray. I don't mean to put this in the end. I probably should put this number one. Pray for your kids. Pray for your kids, because God is on his throne. Jesus builds the church. Somehow God does that. And we know that ultimately we have no control over what our kids do when they get up and out and on their own and make their own choices. So at some point you do have to just release them to the Lord. Just release them and pray. So realize parents do matter, and also keeping the gospel at the center of life and at the center of your church is so important. You don't want that moralistic, therapeutic deism to be at the center of faith, because it doesn't sustain them into college. The gospel of grace. Make sure that our religion is not about a list of do's and don'ts. It's not that God's law of love isn't there. It is, but it has to be grounded first and foremost in what Jesus has done for us and so forth. So that's really important. Now, here's a good resource for you. If you do have teenagers at home who are, they're doing okay in their faith and they're good, they like to read maybe, this is a great book. It's called This Changes Everything, How the Gospel Transforms the Teen Years. And what I love about it is it was written by a teenager. She was 19 years old, And yes, she's exceptional. But she was 19 years old, and so and that was just last year she wrote this. So she understands teen culture. She understands the teen mindset. She knows what kids are into, and she uses language that kids are going to, you know, will be familiar to them. Not the bad stuff, but, you know, stuff that's familiar to them. So it's really good. Let me show you a little promo for it that's actually online. Because if you are involved, like, in any way in your youth ministry, or you could show this to your youth pastor, it's really handy for a small group, because every chapter has questions, and so it could be really easily used in a small group. And I think she does a really good job of keeping the gospel centered in here. So I think it's a really good book. Let me show you the little promo for it.
Let me ask you a question. Has the gospel changed your life? Sure, you can say you believe there's a God, or you were raised in a Christian family, or you're involved in church activities. But has the gospel really changed you? Because that's what makes Jesus different. If he's really entered your life, it will be transformed to the core. If the gospel is true, it will change the things you believe, think, say, and do. It will change your goals and what you treasure, the way you look at yourself and the way you relate to others, the way you invest your time and passion, even what you do for entertainment. Truth is, our lives can't remain the same from the moment Jesus is in us. We become part of a countercultural movement that defies the status quo, stereotypes, and the culture of self. Regardless of our age or experience, we become part of it. We become part of a kingdom and a story and an adventure that changes absolutely everything. So has the gospel changed your life?
So I think that's great, this concept that the gospel changes everything, and that, you know, religion isn't just something we add on Sundays to the rest of what we do in life, but it changes everything about, because the gospel is what guides us into those deep human longings for meaning and satisfaction and even identity. It is through Christ we receive the most amazing identity and so forth. So that's also so important. Another good resource for you, this book, I just finished reading this, Timothy Keller, An Invitation to the Skeptical, Making Sense of God. Now, what I love about Timothy Keller, he was a pastor in Manhattan for many, many decades, so he really understands the secular culture really, really well. And so what he does is he sort of takes all of those questions about meaning and freedom and identity and hope and justice. He tells what the secular culture tells you about how you can find those things. Then he shows how that answer really falls flat in reality. And then he shows how the gospel does make sense of our human quest for meaning and identity and so forth. So what I love about Timothy Keller is he does all the hard work for you. He has read the philosophers and the ancient authors and the modern authors and the playwrights and all of these. I don't know when he has time to breathe, let alone eat, because of all the reading he does. So he does all of that. Then he takes the gems from that and gives them to you so that you have amazing resources. It's a really good book. He writes in a way that most people can really understand. He's not real, you know, he doesn't use enormous words. You know, he's really good. So I would really recommend that book about keeping the gospel at the center of life, because it does change everything about how we live. Third idea is that we need to bring young people into the full life of the church earlier. So when I was growing up, we used to sit at the kids' table when mom and dad were having company, because there wasn't enough room at the table for us. So we loved it, because we could do things at the kids' table that we normally couldn't do, right? Throw food or whatever. And the parents didn't care. They were having their adult conversation and were glad you were happy. But eventually, I got to an age where I didn't want to sit at the kids' table. That's for the kids. And I felt like I was growing up. Maybe I was only 14 or 13 even, but I was like, no, I'm growing up. I need to be at the adult table. I think in some ways, With our kids in church, we kind of keep them at the kids' table too long. And what I mean by that is we keep Sunday school. I'm a big fan of Sunday school. I'm not saying, you know, eliminate Sunday school or youth programs. I think there are things that kids can talk about in a youth group that maybe they don't really want to talk about with their mom and dad, you know, some things. And it also builds friendships. So it's youth groups are wonderful. But how do we get those kids into the full life of the church? Because the plan right now is you stay in youth group when you graduate high school. You're going to go away to college. When you come back to church and we'll see what we got for you. Are they going to come back is the problem. Or are they already gone? So how do we get them into the full life of the church? And what do I mean by the full life? I mean to where they know people outside of youth group age and just the youth group sponsors. Kara Powell and her team, in their research, found that if kids have a 5-to-1 ratio, 5 adults, not relatives, you know, not Uncle Joey and Aunt, you know, Elizabeth, but 5 adults that they're not related to, of multi-generations that they know and that know them, that when they see them at church, they ask, "Hey, Brad, how was your soccer game? Hey, I was praying for you on that test. How did it go?" They actually know about their lives. They care about their lives. If they have a 5-to-1 connection, they are far more likely to stay in the faith and to stay in church when they become a young adult. Wow. So how do we get them connected? Well, I think there are simple ways. I was noticing that when our church serves communion, it's all like people my age and up that are serving. Nothing wrong with that. But it's like, that's something that a junior high kid could do, or certainly a high school kid could serve. And it's not just the service thing, because if it's only service we're interested in, that we can put them in youth group and they can do youth group service projects. But the point is that we bring kids in and now they get to know other people on the communion team. They get to know senior citizen Torin, and they get to know middle-aged woman, you know, whoever, and they get to know someone who's in their 30s, these different age groups of people. They get to know them, and those people get to know them. So that connection. She talks about that more in this fairly new book she has out, Kara Powell, Growing Young, 6 Essential Strategies to Help Young People Discover and Love Your Church. So this is really written to churches, but go ahead and if you know, you're really interested, read it and maybe give some ideas to your pastor or so forth to kind of bring people more into the full life of the church. And then also take advantage of all the resources that are out there to help young people through their doubts and questions. I'm so thankful for people like Timothy Keller and William Lane Craig and these various apologists and thinkers that have great resources to help you when your kid has a question that you're like, I don't know how to answer that. That never really bothered me, but it's apparently bothering them, and I really don't know how to answer their question. There's lots of resources out there. For instance, another Timothy Keller book is Reason for God. And what I love about this is he takes the most common objections to Christianity and he basically deals with them, he answers them. And these are real, real questions he would get at his church. You know, questions like, you know, how could God allow suffering? There can't just be one true religion. Christianity is a straitjacket. You know, what about the church? Hasn't Christianity been really responsible for so much injustice in the world? So he kind of deals with those. And then he gives a positive case for faith in the second half of the book. So I think that's great. This book, Unanswered, by Jeremiah J. Johnson, Lasting Truth for Trending Questions. He deals with mental illness. He deals with when God is silent. You know, if God loves us and he asks us to pray, how come sometimes God is silent? And we don't get a yes or a no or even a hello, you know, I just feel like God's on mute. What about that? So he tackles another kind of group of questions. Great resources. Maybe also all those Case for the Creator, Lee Strobel does a great job of writing for the layperson. So those are really good books. Maybe there's a question about the Bible that your kid will have and you realize you really don't know all that much about the Bible. Maybe you're like, I like to read the Psalms, and I like to read Jesus, and maybe Paul's letters a little bit, and then the Old Testament, I don't know. It's just confusing to me. So maybe you need to shore up your biblical knowledge. You know, how do you do that quickly? Well, there's an amazing resource. It's called thebibleproject.org. It's in your notes there, thebibleproject.org. This is a genius idea of a professor up at Western Seminary, Tim Mackey, and he realized that there was this whole generation of people that were basically Christians, but they were Bible-less Christians. They really didn't know much about the Bible. They kind of knew the Christian message, but they really didn't know the Bible very well. And he got together with a guy in the Silicon Valley who was doing art for high-tech companies, and they produced these videos where they start explaining. They've done every book of the Bible, Genesis through Revelation, and big themes of the Bible and the whole arcing story of the Bible. What I love about him is he shows these themes come up over and over again of humanity's failure and the need for a savior. It's all through the Bible. So I'm just going to show you a tiny little bit, just because we don't have time to play the whole thing, of his Bible video on the book of Genesis. So let me just show you this.
The book of Genesis. It's the first book of the Bible, and its storyline divides into two main parts. There's chapters 1 through 11, which tell the story of God and the whole world. And then there's chapters 12 through 50, which zoom in and tell the story of God and just one man, Abraham, and then his family. And these two parts are connected by a hinge story at the beginning of chapter 12. And this design, it gives us a clue to how to understand the message of the book as a whole and how it introduces the story of the whole Bible. So the book begins with God taking the disorder and the darkness described in the second sentence of the Bible, and God brings out of it order and beauty and goodness. He makes a world where life can flourish. And God makes these creatures called humans, or Adam in Hebrew. He makes them in his image, which has to do with their role and purpose in God's world. So the humans are made to be reflections of God's character out into the world, and they're appointed as God's representatives to rule his world on his behalf, which in context means to harness all of its potential, to care for it, and make it a place where even more life can flourish. God blesses the humans. It's a key word in this book. And he gives them a garden. It's like a place from which they begin starting to build this new world. Now, the key is that the humans have a choice about how they're going to go about building this world. And that's represented by the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Up till now, God has provided and defined what is good and what is not good. But now God is giving the humans the dignity and the freedom of a choice. Are they going to trust God's definition of good and evil, or are they going to seize autonomy and define good and evil for themselves? And the stakes are really high. To rebel against God is to embrace death, because you're turning away from the giver of life himself. This is represented by the tree of life. And so in chapter 3, a mysterious figure, a snake, enters into the story. The snake's given no introduction other than it's a creature that God made. And it becomes clear that it's a creature in rebellion against God, and it wants to lead the humans into rebellion and their death. The snake tells a different story about the tree and the choice. It says that seizing the knowledge of good and evil are not going to bring death, that it's actually the way to life and becoming like God themselves. Now, the irony of this is tragic, because we know the humans, they're already like God. They were made to reflect God's image. But instead of trusting God, the humans seize autonomy, they take the knowledge of good and evil for themselves, and in an instant, the whole story spirals out of control. The first casualty is human relationships. The man and the woman, they suddenly realize how vulnerable they are now. They can't even trust each other. And so they make clothes and they hide their bodies from one another. The second casualty is that intimacy between God and the humans is lost. So they go and run and hide from God. And then when God finds them, they start this game of blame shifting about who rebelled first. Now, right here, the story stops, and there's a series of short poems where God declares to the snake and then to the humans the tragic consequences of their actions. God first tells the snake that despite its apparent victory, it is destined for defeat, to eat dust. God promises that one day a seed or a descendant will come from the woman who's going to deliver a lethal strike to the snake's head. Which sounds like great news, but this victory is going to come with a cost, because the snake too will deliver a lethal strike to the descendant's heel as it's being crushed. It's a very mysterious promise of this wounded victor. But in the flow of the story so far, you see this is an act of God's grace. The humans, they've just rebelled, and what does God do? He promises to rescue them. But this doesn't erase the consequences of the human's decision. So God informs them that now every aspect of their life together, at home and out in the field, it's going to be fraught with grief and pain because of the rebellion, all leading to their death. From here, the story then spirals downward. Chapters 3.
Okay, so that gives you a little idea of what they're like. Every book of the Bible, I binge watched these. One day, I watched the whole thing because I just thought they were so good. You get this amazing flow, and they're only like 6-7 minutes long, so they're very watchable with your kids or just for you to kind of get a better handle on not every detail, but the big story that these books are telling. Another option for kind of increasing your own learning, and maybe with your kids, is Dr. William Lane Craig. He's probably the foremost Christian philosopher. He's brilliant. He's published with peer-reviewed articles and so forth. And he has done a lot of work on the issue of the existence of God. He does debates with atheists and so forth. But what I love that he did very recently, and you can go to YouTube and you just put in Dr. Craig videos. He has a whole group of these videos where he basically explains some of the classical arguments for the existence of God, but he does them in a very creative way rather than just lecturing. It's very visual. So let me just show you. There's lots of these in there. This is just a little sample of one of them.
From galaxies and stars, down to atoms and subatomic particles, the very structure of our universe is determined by these numbers. These are the fundamental constants and quantities of the universe. Scientists have come to the shocking realization that each of these numbers has been carefully dialed to an astonishingly precise value, a value that falls within an exceedingly narrow, life-permitting range. If any one of these numbers were altered by even a hair's breadth, no physical, interactive life of any kind could exist anywhere. There'd be no stars, no life, no planets, no chemistry. Consider gravity, for example. The force of gravity is determined by the gravitational constant. If this constant varied by just 1 in 10 to the 60th parts, none of us would exist. To understand how exceedingly narrow this life-permitting range is, imagine a dial divided into 10 to the 60th increments. To get a handle on how many tiny points on the dial this is, compare it to the number of cells in your body, or the number of seconds that have ticked by since time began. If the gravitational constant had been out of tune by just one of these infinitesimally small increments, the universe would either have expanded and thinned out so rapidly that no stars could form and life couldn't exist, or it would have collapsed back on itself with the same result. No stars, no planets, and no life. Or consider the expansion.
So they're really well done. There's science in there. There's philosophy in there. So I think they're a great tool, again, and for your own knowledge, and then also to use with your kids. We're just about out of time. Let me just highlight a few. On all these things, I'm giving you some resources. The bookstore said she'd pull some of these together for me. So like he has a book called On Guard that also has a student edition that I think is really well done. On questions of science and evolution, I've given you a number of books there. I really love John Lennox. God's Undertaker has Science Buried God. And what I love about him is he's a professor of mathematics at Oxford University and a philosopher of science. When you see him, he looks like an Irish grandpa. He's just the nicest man. But he's brilliant, and that's a really, really good book. And there's some other ones there that I've recommended. Also, some websites for you. There's a Illustra Media has done these amazing DVDs that talk about, they're kind of the intelligent design proponents, that there's evidence for design in creation, and they go through, for instance, the flight of birds or the echolocation system of a dolphin to show how complex these systems are and to kind of question the evolutionary story. Now, I'm not saying that you have to, you know, reject evolution, because there are people who are very smart, who are theistic evolutionists, like Francis Collins. He's a very solid believer. So, you know, there's different ways you can go. I think exposing your kids to different ways that people understand these things is a really good idea. So there's some things there on sexuality, about religious pluralism, and then some great books just about Christianity, about evidences for that, and also some online resources. I love Unbelievable. It's a UK show. It's with Justin Brierley. And what I love is that he brings a Christian and a non-Christian together, and they have a dialogue about, very cordial usually, about a particular topic. Can human beings find meaning without God, for instance? And they have a dialogue about that. You can listen to a podcast, you know, on your commute, or I do it when I'm cleaning house, I'll put one on, and you can grow in your own understanding of these things so that you're ready to help your kids or somebody else's kids through some of these tough questions. So I'm sorry we've run out of time. Hopefully that was helpful to at least get you thinking and pick up some of those resources for you. God bless. Yep.